Good afternoon. I hope everyone's had a chance to grab a bite to eat if they were hungry, and thank you for attending my session. I'm Penny Cutt with Edgewater Resources. A little on my background, I come from the regulatory world. I worked county, state, and federal before going to the private sector as a consultant, and so I'm a marine ecologist, but I think once a regulator, always a regulator, so I often say I'm a recovering regulator. That being said, I'm usually accused of being an attorney or an engineer. For whatever reason, people don't usually get regulator or marine ecologist out of it. So I'm going to talk a little bit today about navigating the marina process in environmentally sensitive coastal areas. I don't know if we've got anyone from Florida or California or Hawaii or Puerto Rico or Virgin Islands. If not, this may be new and make you feel good about how quick and easy and straightforward your permitting process is. I think we can, we got a small group here. If you want to just ask questions as they go, I'm fine with interruptions and questions rather than saving them to the end since we've got kind of a whole hour here. So I'm going to go through some species that make our permitting process more challenging. I'm from South Florida, and a lot of the project examples I have in here are South Florida and the Caribbean. And then I'll go through some regulations, which is dry and boring, but I'll speed through those and get through some project examples with more pretty pictures that are actually taken on site. So some of the species that we'll talk about here that give us the most grief in our regulatory permitting process in the Caribbean areas, in Hawaii, California, South Florida, and the Bahamas, and further out in the Eastern Caribbean include the sea turtles and small-toothed sawfish, mangroves, oysters and hard-bottom corals, manatees, and seagrass. And a lot of those species are mobile, which gives us an advantage to permitting them, and we'll get into some of that as well. So starting out with those motile species, we've got the sea turtle, sawfish, and sturgeon. And those species, because they can escape areas of construction, they hear the noise, they get scared off and move away as long as they're not contained within your turbidity curtains while you're doing renovations, we've got construction conditions that if we hold our contractors to those construction conditions, then oftentimes we can get to an easier, quicker permitting process, permitting decision. We'll get into some of the rules and regulations pertaining to these species. We've got a lot of species to contend with, and they all have different regulations and protections on them. So most of these species are protected under the Florida and Federal Endangered Species Act. In Florida, we've got the State Act, which includes most of the federal, all of the federal species, and then additional Florida-listed species. And then, as I mentioned, we've got some construction conditions for some of these species that if you agree to adhere to them, have an observer on the boat, have signs posted, make sure that you're only working during daylight hours, they may add a little bit of cost to your construction project, but it's generally minimal. And so if you were to encounter one of these species during construction, you'd have to stop work until they move out of the construction area on their own. When we're working in and around mangroves, it gets a little bit easier. The key here is avoidance and minimization. Mangroves are protected nationally, internationally, for the habitat they provide. They stabilize our shorelines, and they have both the rookery factor in their foliage as well as the root system that provides habitat for fish and crabs and crustaceans. We have three species of mangroves that we commonly encounter in South Florida and the Caribbean, and 54 species worldwide. And so generally, historically, the red mangroves have always been the furthest out in the water in the deepest areas, and they're known as the walking trees, and they collect sediment, and they hold dirt, and they expand the land. Well, with climate change and sea level rise and resiliency, we're starting to find the three species more and more intermingled through the years because that coastal salt water is coming in. Now, mangroves can grow in totally freshwater areas, but they're generally outcompeted by other freshwater species. And so with that salt water coming in, the higher high tides, we're having some of the salt water, the freshwater species, eradicated and taken over by more mangroves. So historically, we've always had the red mangroves the furthest waterward, the black mangroves behind them, and then the whites highest up in the on the shoreline. Seagrass is always a challenge when we're permitting our marina projects, dredging, marina expansion, deepening. We always have to do a benthic survey for seagrass and other benthic resources, and those surveys have to be done between June 1st and September 30th, the seagrass growing season. And so that gets a little bit challenging with our projects. There's a lot of anecdotal information available as to where seagrasses are present, where they're growing, and habitat, but the agencies generally want a application with a benthic survey conducted the seagrass growing season prior to application. So our permitting processes for marina replacement, marina expansion, dredging type work generally takes about 2 years, a year and a half to 2 years. And that pre-application benthic survey will support that application through the process. So if you come back later for a permit modification, you may have to do an updated seagrass survey. We generally try to avoid and minimize our impacts to seagrass. Seagrass mitigation is very risky. Seagrasses grow where they want to be, and seagrass mitigation runs about $1 million an acre. Hard bottom is a new concept for a lot of people. Hard bottom is just that. It's a rocky substrate, unlike coral reefs, but it provides a substrate for a lot of benthic resources to colonize on. Now, hard bottom is generally ephemeral, meaning it's sometimes buried, it's sometimes exposed, so it moves around. So a lot of times we have to correlate our geotech information with our benthic survey to find out where the hard bottom is, because we need to protect that hard bottom. It's regulated as a central fish habitat by Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Management and Conservation Act, and it's very highly valued, particularly in South Florida. And so we generally need to avoid hard bottom, and we'll get into some project examples with hard bottom. Corals, I think everybody pretty much understands the importance of corals. Right now we are undergoing the largest coral disease outbreak in history. It's killed off entire species of the coral reef tract, which runs from about southern Palm Beach County down to the Florida Keys. It's taken over the entire reef tract, and it's popping up all over the Caribbean. There's a big effort underway with the universities to capture some of the genetic species data bank, and they're sending those coral specimens all across the country to universities who are trying to grow out the corals so that they can later replant them onto the reefs. So a few years back, several of the coral species were listed. There's 22 total listed. Of those, we only have 7 in the Caribbean. Of those 7, we did at one point have all 7 of them in Florida. The first 2 listed were the 2 Acropora corals, the staghorn and the elkhorn. There are survey protocol guidelines for those 2 species. The other species, we're completely losing some of those species, including the pillar coral. Manatees, everybody knows manatees, thinks of them as their cute little friendly creatures showing up around docks and marinas. The problem is people all too often throw them a head of lettuce, give them the hose, they roll over on their back, and you spray their belly with the pressure nozzle, and they hang out, and they love it. But it encourages them to hang around marinas, to hang around boats, to approach boats, and then they get those lovely prop scars up and down their back, which get infected and sometimes kill them. So manatees are wonderful, adorable creatures, but they've recovered quite a bit. They were at one point listed as threatened, but with the recovery of the population, they've come back and they've been downlisted to endangered. There are manatee construction conditions that we require contractors adhere to, abide by during construction, including having observers looking for the manatees and, again, not working at night. There are 13 counties in Florida that are required to have manatee protection plans, and within those manatee protection plans is a component called the boat facility siting plan. And each of those boat facility siting plans are very, very different. They were all individually developed. They were approved by the county and the state, and they're enforced they must be adhered to. The Federal Fish and Wildlife Service looks at them as well. And in Dade County in particular and a few other counties, they almost stop additional powerboat slips. So in Dade County, between the limitations within the Manatee Protection Plan and the limitations in the Biscayne Bay Aquatic Preserve Act, There are very few places where additional powerboat slips could potentially be authorized, and those areas are built out, and the zoning codes often preclude additional slips. So single-family residential can still get additional slips, yes?
Just in general amenities, I know Florida has a lot of regulations there, but amenities are moving further and further up the coast. South Carolina had a lot this year. Is South Carolina moving towards the same sort of regulations as Florida?
I haven't heard that they are, but the Fish and Wildlife Service regulates them as well wherever they are. And so anytime you've got a potential effect to a listed species, you have to have an endangered species consultation. So at least at the federal level they are. I'm not aware at the state or local level if they're doing the same. Another question in the back? So they look at the construction methodology, and they look at construction measures, but construction of a pier isn't necessarily precluded for manatees. A pier doesn't necessarily pose a threat to manatees. So we've had situations, and there's a project example, where there were concerns with a proposed floating breakwater potentially crushing a manatee, but one of the biggest threats to manatees in South Florida is actually the floodgates, the salinity structures on all the canals draining the Everglades. Even though they all have all different types of sensors on them to pick up a manatee and raise back up, and there's a lot of different technology for all the different sensors, most of them are pretty ineffective due to the water flows coming out during storm events. They've got to adjust the sensitivity so that it doesn't get set off and open back up if they're trying to keep it closed. And so, unfortunately, a lot of them, they necropsy all the manatees that are found dead, and most of them, or a lot of them, are crushed from the floodgates. Sure. That I don't know. So anything you do around a listed threatened or endangered species that changes them from doing what they would be doing naturally if you weren't there is considered harassment under the Endangered Species Act. That's actually my son swimming with a manatee in Crystal River, which is the only place in Florida that there are licensed operators that can bring you over there to swim with manatees. They do have people in the water with you making sure that you're only touching with one finger. You are allowed to touch them. They do kind of get hoarded and cornered, but there is one place in Florida you can swim with them. It's in a Florida spring. They aggregate there in the wintertime, Florida winter, when the spring water, 72 degrees year-round, is warmer than the ocean water. For me, that's about the coldest water I get in. So now we're going to get into some regulations. The federal regulatory program, the agencies that we generally deal with these species, with these issues, with environmentally sensitive projects, projects proposing to do work where there are ecological resources present, include the Environmental Protection Agency, Fish and Wildlife Service, and then two different divisions in the National Marine Fisheries Service, the Protected Resources Division and the Habitat Conservation Division. So the Corps of Engineers, being the action agency, because they're the agency that can actually issue a permit, has three authorities that they issue permits under. And generally, you get a Corps permit, you don't really care what authority it's being issued under. It doesn't really matter. The process is essentially the same. But any work in navigable waters, so any waters that you can float a boat in that can lead to interstate commerce, people coming there to, you know, go kayaking or paddleboarding, is regulated under Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act, which has not been modified since 1899, requires a Corps permit. Section 404 of the Clean Water Act regulates when fill is placed in those waters, waters of the U.S., and those waters of the U.S. don't have to be navigable, but that's another topic. And then we've got Section 103, which most of you will probably never deal with, but that is ocean disposal of dredged spoil. So if you were dredging, say the Corps of Engineers is dredging an inlet, a federal channel, and they're disposing of that material offshore, that would require a Section 103 permit. When the contractors were bidding on the Miami Tunnel to get the trucks from the mainland to Miami to government cut to Port Miami, without having to go across the causeway. They all wanted to dispose of that excavated material in an ODMDS because there was a lot of material and that was the cheapest way for them to dispose of it. Unfortunately, that was excavated material and it didn't qualify to go to an ODMDS. So the federal government, before they issue any permit or fund any project, has to comply with a whole slew of federal regulations, including the Clean Air Act and ADA. But the three acts and regulations that we deal with primarily for environmentally sensitive areas are NEPA, the Endangered Species Act, and Magnuson-Stevens, which regulates essential fish habitat. So NEPA doesn't stipulate that you have to build something that avoids ecological impacts. NEPA just requires that you identify the effects of a proposed project and put it out there to the public and get public feedback. Now, if you want to avoid doing an environmental impact statement, you've got to mitigate your project to a FONSI, a mitigated FONSI, which is a finding of no significant impact. And to get there, people think mitigation, okay, I've just got to build somewhere else to offset that habitat. Mitigation is sequential, and that's at the county, state, and federal level. Mitigation first requires avoidance, and then it requires minimization, and then it requires compensation. So we have a lot of people that come down from up north who want to build a marina, or they want to redevelop some upland properties, and it's only a feasible project if they can accommodate, say, 60 sporties 50 foot or bigger. Well, there's ecological resources there. The cost of mitigating seagrass is often cost prohibitive, and you can't just dredge it there because you want to put your marina there. You've got to demonstrate that avoidance, minimization, and then compensation. And so you've also got to do both an on-site and off-site alternatives analysis, and I've got some case studies talking about that as well. And so if you do have ecological impacts that are significant, and significant is a key word, I'd encourage you to never use the word significant in a federal permit application because that means you'll have to do an environmental impact statement. That'll set you back a minimum of 18 months, usually a lot longer, and a whole lot of money. And then you'll end up having to do mitigation anyway. So under the Endangered Species Act, your consultation process can be pretty rigorous. There was a Save the Manatee lawsuit back in 2001 that made the process even more rigorous around the time when the manatees were uplisted from endangered to threatened, downlisted from endangered to threatened. There are provisions if you are getting a core permit, so you have a federal nexus, and you need a biological opinion, so your project may affect the species. So the Corps of Engineers makes a decision, no effect, may affect, not likely to adversely affect, and may affect. If your project may affect the species, you need a biological opinion. And that biological opinion consultation period is generally 90 days with a 45-day extension. Very frequently, these agencies exceed that 135 days, and the Corps still has to wait before they can issue a permit. Protected Resources Division of National Marine Fisheries Service takes even longer. Their workload and staff ratio is much, much greater, and their number of consultations is exorbitant. Number of species that they have to consult on is ridiculous. And so it'll often take us a year to get through National Marine Fisheries Service Protected Resources Division consultation. Now, Fish and Wildlife Service, and in our world, in the coastal aquatic environment, regulates the manatees. They also regulate turtles when they're nesting on the beach, but when they're swimming in the ocean or our estuaries, they're regulated by National Marine Fisheries Service Protected Resources Division. And then we've got Johnson seagrass, small tooth sawfish, and the corals that are also under National Marine Fisheries. If you design your project to have no effect to these species, then you don't have to consult. Now, if you want to consult ahead of time without the Corps, there are actually no formal procedures for that consultation process. And even though it's 135 days for formal consultation, if it's informal consultation, there's no timeline. The timeline doesn't really matter because they often don't adhere to the timeline anyway. So it's a challenging process, but what they've done in South Florida to a large extent is created keys, dichotomous keys that'll get you through the process. And sometimes you can design your project to be consistent with the dichotomous key to give you a concurrence for a may affect not likely to adversely affect determination that doesn't need to be verified by Fish and Wildlife or the Corps of Fish and Wildlife or National Marine Fisheries. So Endangered Species Act can be a big headache, a big time sink, and time is money. Essential fish habitat is regulated under the Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Management Act, and that is also through National Marine Fisheries Service, but that is through the Habitat Conservation Division. Now, unconsolidated sand is regulated as EFH, essential fish habitat, because it provides those infaunal critters that live in the sand that some of our commercially and recreationally important fisheries depend on. They fortunately don't regulate that unconsolidated sand as highly as they do seagrass habitat, corals, and hard bottom, but essential fish habitat is a big thorn in our side when we're permitting projects in South Florida and Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands as well. So the process for consulting on essential fish habitat is completely different than the process for consulting on threatened and endangered species. Generally, we get an initial response from Habitat Conservation Division within 30 days on what their take is on the project. Oftentimes, we get, if it's a straightforward project, we'll get a letter saying we don't have concerns. If it is a project they've got a lot of concerns about, they'll issue what's called a 3A letter, which is Provisions 3A of their consultation procedures. And it basically says, we have some concerns, we need some more time to evaluate this, and what you don't want is a 3B letter. Because once you get a 3B letter, then we get into the Corps talking to the Department of Commerce, and it gets challenging to permit your project. Not to say we can't get through it, but you've got to offer up some more ecological lift to offset those impacts, demonstrate further avoidance and minimization. The states have a lot of authority as well. And when you look at the county, state, and federal processes, there's a lot of what on the surface appears to be duplicative action. And the Corps of Engineers has delegated some of their authority to counties, they've delegated some of their authority to states, and the states have delegated some of their authority to counties. So where it's possible for them to delegate it to another program so there's less duplicity, they do. But oftentimes, on a lot of the projects that our firm works on, we do need separate permits from all three agencies because they all have different rules and regulations that they've got to abide by, different questions they've got to ask, and different things they need to demonstrate. So what's critical is that you understand what it is that they need to get through to be able to issue you a permit instead of just looking at, oh, my God, why are they asking these ridiculous questions? Because if we spoon-feed them the answers and the information they need, then we can get to that permit decision quicker. One of the things that I always tell the biologists I work with is I don't want to see anything on a request for additional information that I can't tell the client I told you so. A lot of times we will have projects that propose impacts and we'll tell the client we've got to do a flushing study. We've got to propose mitigation. We've got to do XYZ. Some of the clients say do it. I want to get this permitted as quickly as possible, time is money. Other clients, often public clients, will say, until I see it on a request for additional information, I can't authorize that additional budget. That's fine. I just want to let you know up front that this is going to be required. The states also have to issue water quality certification and coastal zone management consistency before the Corps of Engineers can issue their permit. So that means the Corps permit can't be issued until after the state permit is issued. In certain situations, for example, natural gas liquefaction plants offshore or some of the offshore wind farms, there isn't necessarily a state permit requirement, but we've still got to get coastal zone management consistency and water quality certification from the states before the Corps can issue their permit. So, but most of the time, the state permit provides that CZMA and water quality cert before the Corps can issue. So in Florida, we've got a very well-established program. It was interesting seeing the Clean Marina program that was presented in the last session. We've got a very well-established Clean Marina program, and that actually is really good advertising for a lot of our marinas to be able to say, we're a clean marina, we're a clean boatyard, and our boaters want to patronize those facilities because it makes them feel good. They know, first of all, aesthetically and you know, walking around the facility, it's going to be clean and neat and doing the right thing. But it also provides a nicer facility and a feel-good to a lot of the clients. So with our ecological impacts, we have to look at functional assessments. So years ago, we just looked at what we were impacting and what we're proposing to offset it. Now we actually look at the aquatic functions and values of what we're impacting. So what functions and values is that impacted habitat providing, and what functions and values is that mitigation providing? And we look at it with a functional assessment that enables us to compare apples to apples. So it gets everything down to credits and debits. And there are a lot of functional assessments. Some are specific for certain areas. But the state of Florida came up with something several years ago called UMAM, the Uniform Mitigation Assessment Methodology. And it's very subjective on its face. But when you actually apply it, the different agencies and the consultants that apply it come up with surprisingly consistent mitigation requirements. There are some differences. The way that it's calculated, the discount rate at the state level and the federal level are different. The state uses a 3% discount rate and the feds use a 7% discount rate. But whoever comes up with the largest mitigation requirement is basically what you've got to end up doing anyway. And in Florida, our state program is administered by either the Florida Department of Environmental Protection or one of the five water management districts. And so years ago, we used to have six set of rules. And several years ago, they combined the codes for the environmental permitting. So we just have one rule, 62.330 of the Florida Administrative Code. So we've got one rule for the environmental, but for our surface water management permitting, we still have five separate rules because managing surface water in Florida still varies quite a bit across our very flat state. Again, we talked a lot about the rules and regulations and state of Florida, and I don't want to bore you too much with what the state of Florida requires, but it is another level of permitting that we've got to do in addition to the federal permitting. And then we've got our counties. Some of our counties have environmental regulatory programs that are even more rigorous than the state programs. And so they can't be less rigorous. They obviously can easily be more rigorous. And so when we do our permitting at the in Southeast Florida, as I mentioned, a lot of times we have to get county, state, and federal, and we need to make sure that we've met everybody's rules and regulations. We've got to get approvals oftentimes from governing board at the state level, from commission at the county level, and individual permits at the federal level. So it can be a rigorous process when we're proposing impacts to ecological resources. Even what appears to be a straightforward project in South Florida and the Caribbean has a lot of things that we've got to deal with. So now we kind of got through some of that regulatory boring stuff. I'm going to take you on a tour of some project examples in Florida, and then we're going to move to some international project examples. So this is a project we're working on right now. This is the Melbourne Riverwalk.
Just a quick note, that's where I grew up.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. So you know this marina? I remember when it...
It was a restaurant before that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's right in the flight path also of the airport. Planes go right over top of it.
Yeah, yeah. So you can see on the north part of the property, there was a boat barn there, a dry stack facility. So up here we've got a dry stack facility. We've got an old forklift launch pad. There was a marina in the north part of one facility in the north end and a separate facility in the south end. The hurricanes of 2004-05 kind of took care of that for the most part. There's still some dilapidated structures out there. You can see an old dredged entrance channel. If you applied to do this today, it probably would be denied. Very shallow outside of the marina. And so, as we do with most of our projects, when we start off, as soon as we're brought into a project, we do our bathymetric survey and our benthic survey. And we found very dense macroalgae outside of the marina. But within the marina basin, we found this nasty, silty material. Not uncommon. We've got a deeper marina basin and very shallow areas surrounding it. And so nothing can grow in this. We did have a manatee, and that is an actual picture we took. We did have a manatee hanging out in the project. It's been there, it's been there pretty much every time we've been to the site. This is actually, it looks a lot like seagrass, but it's a macroalgae called Caulerpa. And it's pretty much surrounding the marina. And it's very dense. And when we have dense macroalgae beds like this, they're regulated like seagrass because they provide a lot of habitat like seagrass and hiding places and foraging areas for fish and crabs and shrimp. The manatee must be eating it too. And in this area, it is protected and they are looking at it as an important species. A lot of drift algae, particularly on the south side of the project. And on the north side of the project, we did have a little bit of seagrass, and there's some mangroves along the shoreline just beyond that. So what we're proposing to do is deepen the marina. Removing the silt will actually improve water quality and potentially allow some of this macroalgae to colonize the marina basin. If the depth difference is too much, then the macroalgae and seagrasses can't grow in. But with the gentle side slopes necessary to hold the dredging slopes that we've designed, we anticipate some colonization within the marina basin. So we're just submitting those applications now as we speak. This is a project. This is a mooring field just south of Melbourne where we were. This is Jensen Beach Causeway. And in this southwest corner of the causeway is a popular anchorage, haphazard anchorage, opportunistic anchorage. And areas that are good anchorages are generally good for ecological resource colonization. They don't go real well together because you're throwing the hook and you're ripping up seagrass, but the same things that the boaters like when they're traveling the area to anchor in, the seagrasses like. Those calm, protected waters, shallow areas that are relatively safe. Now, you would expect a pretty large fetch given the distance of the water, and this is the site that we actually had a floating wave dissipator proposed in this area where we did have some seagrass. And the agencies had concerns with that floating wave dissipator crushing a manatee. But when we ran, collected some field data and modeled the wind to wave conditions, we found that we didn't actually need that wave dissipator. So we eliminated that from the project. Originally, Martin County wanted to put a marina in here. And because of the shallow water depths and the seagrasses, we weren't able to get a marina permitted in that area. But the mooring field was sorely needed because there is so much mooring in this area. And so when you propose a mooring field, you have to have a mooring field managed mooring field management plan. And you also have to have upland amenities, restrooms, and a dock for the dinghies to come in. Otherwise, they're all coming into shore, beaching the dinghies on the seagrass, tying up to mangrove roots. And so we had this one quadrant that had less than 1% seagrass coverage. Well, the agencies required that we stipulate in our managed mooring field management plan that we would only put a vessel on a mooring in this area if there were no adequately sized moorings available anywhere else in the facility, and as soon as another mooring became available, we would move that boat out of there. So seagrasses are ephemeral, just like hard bottom, and sometimes they're emergent, sometimes they're not. Now, in this situation, the sediment quality in this area and the light transparency really wasn't that conducive to seagrass growth, but the agency still made us do that. We did get almost full funding for this marina with a series of grants, and we're moving forward. The Martin County was providing some in-kind matching services and didn't have to lay out any money, but the commissioner that was proposing the marina had some enemies and the project got axed, but from what I understand, the project's moving forward again on its own now, so it's hopefully getting built in the very near future. We also had some residents in this area that were NIMBY, not in my backyard, didn't want the mooring field there. Instead, you know, we had all these derelict vessels, sunken vessels all the time, chronic problem, but they didn't want the managed mooring field there, and so they responded to the state and requested a 120 administrative hearing. We represented in the county at the 120 hearing, and we were successful in that project. Did get the DEP permit. So this is some of the less derelict vessels that were often mooring in that area. Here's some of the seagrasses that we were finding there. Johnson seagrass is a seagrass species that's listed as threatened. It's the only listed seagrass species. It tends to grow in areas where other seagrasses don't, It tends to grow in very silty areas. It can grow in very, very shallow areas where it's sometimes exposed. And there's a lot of question as to whether Johnson seagrass is actually an introduced invasive species as opposed to a native species. They've never found flowers. It's been reproducing. So sometimes seagrasses will travel through ballast water and establish themselves. And then this is another type of seagrass that we found, you know, primarily in these areas down here where it was shallower. So this is another project. Now we're at the Jupiter Harborside Project, so we're in Palm Beach County now. And sometimes your mitigation cannot cost you anything. So what we've got is there was an old marine facility that was right in and against the mangroves in here. And the new design facility was pushed out further to get to deeper water to accommodate larger vessels, which is clearly the trend. The access walkways were put through the mangroves, narrow access walkways where they didn't impact primary trunks of mangroves. And the mitigation for the seagrass impacts for the access walkways was actually removing the old docks. So all we had to do here was go out there and dive it once a year for 5 years and confirm that the seagrasses grew in over time, which they did. Seagrasses will grow where they want to be. They won't grow just because you want to put them somewhere else. So you can see in this area, here's a quadrat where we're actually counting short shoots of seagrass blades within a specified size of an area. Here's some of the seagrass that's coming in. That's Halophila decipiens, shoal grass. That's one of the early colonizing species that comes in and stabilizes our sediments. This is the Town of Palm Beach Town Docks Project. The Town of Palm Beach wanted to accommodate larger vessels, deeper drafts, wider berths. And so they needed to update this marina, and they needed to dredge this marina. So again, jump in the water during seagrass growing season, confirm that there was no seagrass within the marina basin, but at the south end, you can see these markers here, they're marking a rock ledge. And that rock ledge is actually considered essential fish habitat. It's hard bottom, didn't really have any corals or any important macroalgae on it, but it was holding several fish. And so the agencies wanted mitigation. National Marine Fisheries Service Habitat Conservation Division wanted mitigation for those impacts to essential fish habitat to get the permit. And so it is much shallower out here, and there were seagrasses up here in the shallow areas, but within the marina basin, it was pretty barren. We didn't really have much anything. But you can see a couple fish here, some sheep's head on the hard bottom. So part of their mitigation involved, we've got a lot of dredge holes in South Florida, and those dredge holes are water quality sinks. They're deep holes where material was excavated for upland construction, fill mangroves, fill wetlands. And as mitigation, the counties do a lot of dredge hole filling to create seagrass habitat, and in some cases to create islands with different wetland habitats, mangroves and whatnot on them. And so it was a bit of a win-win where the Town of Palm Beach had a lot of excavated spoil that they needed to dispose of. They were able to dispose of some of their excavated spoil within an existing Palm Beach County project. And they were also required to take the concrete dock demolition material once they cut it down to size and trimmed off all exposed rebar to a artificial reef site just south of Palm Beach Inlet. They weren't real happy about that, but made the agencies happy and got them a permit. So now we are at Curry Park, which is in the city of West Palm Beach. This is an existing boat ramp with some not-so-functional finger piers. They needed longer finger piers, wider spaces between the finger piers, some improvements to make this a more functional boat ramp. You can see the piers are pretty short. You know, nowadays in South Florida, it's not uncommon to have people trying to launch 45-footers on our boat ramps that were designed for 20-footers. So a lot of the slopes and grades have to be adjusted for that demand. Parking spaces have to be adjusted for that demand. And so we did find a few blades of seagrass. That looks like Johnson's seagrass right here, which is federally listed. So then we've got enter endangered species consultation. But when we've got such low coverage, the aquatic functions and values are minimal of a sparse resource like that. And it's clearly a functional marina basin that needed to be dredged. And so part of the mitigation here was these fill pads here for mangroves, and the riprap revetments surrounding the mangrove area dissipate wave energy. So once that wave energy is dissipated, you can get seagrass colonization right in front of it where you didn't. You had scour from the waves refracting off the bulkhead previously. Now we're moving down into Dade County, and this is the Island Gardens Marina. This was a mega yacht marina. I actually issued this permit when I was still at the Corps of Engineers, and it followed me to the private sector. So this project was approved through a City of Miami referendum. They wanted a boat ramp, a marina to accommodate mega yachts in this area within the City of Miami. Well, this area was previously dredged and filled numerous times. It had seagrasses, it had sponges, it had corals. Right along the federal turning basin wall, there were some very large, really nice corals growing. And there's a lot of water flow and movement through here. And so it helped those resources grow and prosper. And so when we looked at this project site and looked at the ecological resources that were identified as the federal agency reviewing the project, I said we need to do an off-site alternatives analysis, because to accommodate mega yachts, we had to dredge out the whole marina basin. But with the impacts that were proposed by the project, I said, well, we need to look at an off-site alternatives analysis. And they said, okay, we'll look throughout the City of Miami and see what else is here. I said, well, no, actually, it's a mega yacht marina. We got to look at the scope of that alternatives analysis, and they weren't real happy with me, but they had to look at the Tri-County area, Broward, Palm Beach County, as well as throughout Dade County. So the off-site alternatives analysis, as I expected, showed that this is the best site for a marina like this. They had deep water from the federal turning basin, short distance and little opportunity to interact with manatees from the federal channel at government cut, but they needed a lot of mitigation to offset the impacts associated with the project. Certainly made sense to put the project here. Couldn't avoid and minimize too much because of the target vessels they were trying to accommodate. You had to dredge the whole area out to get those vessels in there. The shape of the marina wasn't ideal because water currents and navigation is a bit of a nightmare, but the applicant at the time wanted to match the upland architecture design for the site, and from what I understand, they're not operating at full capacity, in part because of the currents and the difficulties getting in and out of there, but neither here nor there. So again, we've got these dredge holes that are very deep that were dredged to get fill for the Causeway Islands, and a lot of the shallower dredge holes have been filled through other mitigation projects and through county opportunistic county projects with county funding, but the deep dredge holes are very expensive to fill, and they're not often utilized for mitigation because you only get mitigation credit for the ecological lift. So it's only the surface area that provides seagrass habitat or sponge habitat or coral habitat. So you need a lot of fill. Some of these dredge holes are 15, 18 feet deep, and the surrounding areas are about 3 to 5. And so with a project of the size of Island Gardens, they had a lot of dredged material to dispose of. They were able to fill these two dredge holes, cap them with seagrass-compatible material, and plant seagrass on them and relocate some of the corals and sponges and hard bottom from the actual dredge site as mitigation, and then they've got to monitor it for 5 years and ensure success. It's a bit interesting because we're having a severe seagrass die-off, and so their background is having some die-offs as well that you can't attribute to project. Another project, Port Miami, in their master plan, wanted to do a similar project to Island Gardens. Island Gardens being right here, they wanted to do a similar project right here on the southwest corner of the port. Jumped in the water, did our benthic survey, found a lot of seagrass, dense seagrass in areas that weren't previously impacted. So a little bit different than the Island Gardens project because this wasn't a previously disturbed area. It was more relatively pristine habitat for a developed city like Miami with runoff and everything else, but it was very high value. You can see in this area we've got a natural shoal that's never been dredged, and we had very dense resources. put together a couple conceptual designs for projects that tried to avoid and minimize impacts to resources, but still met the intent of the city of Miami. But when we ran calculations and gave them ballpark estimates of what mitigation would cost them, they dropped the project, which was probably the right decision. At some point, they'll get a cruise terminal or someone in there that wants to build there and do the mitigation and make it happen. So heading further down to the Florida Keys. Did I miss one? No. Heading further down to the Florida Keys, Monroe County had us do a mooring field feasibility study. They've got the large mooring field at Boca Chica that mitigated a lot of problems associated with mooring. We had a lot of blackwater discharges in there. There was a lot of vessels utilizing Boca Chica. Their water quality is horrible. And once they put in that managed mooring field and actually came up with their own pump-out vessel that they didn't charge people for. The pump-out vessel that Martin County uses is Miss Poop. I don't remember what it stands for, but it was a free pump-out vessel as well. Monroe County has a free pump-out service, too, because there's so many people haphazardly anchoring, and to get a handle on some of the water quality and discharges, even though we've got the Clean Vessel Act that requires your masterator to be locked at all times while inland, you know, people are pumping out overnight and it's really hard to regulate. So if the county provides free pump out services, they can get a better handle on it from the people that actually will use it. So we looked at several sites throughout Monroe County and designed mooring fields, potential mooring fields, recognizing that we needed an upland facility to potentially get a mooring field approved. And so we met with marinas in the area to see if they'd be interested in partnering with the county in providing that upland amenity, a dinghy dock for the vessels, and boaters, restrooms, showers, laundry facilities. And Monroe County decided that they wanted to move forward with the Stock Island project because they did have so much anchoring down there, anchoring in seagrasses, anchoring in shallow areas, derelict vessels. Challenge is, there's no boating access areas around the Navy base. There's a lot of seagrass, and there's a lot of shallow areas, and we're within the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary, so we've got additional layers of regulation. But mooring fields are a good thing. Moorings limit impacts to seagrass. We don't have haphazard anchoring and anchor drags in the seagrass. Our moorings in South Florida are all required to have floats to keep the mooring lines above the substrate at all times. And as we know, boats float around their mooring site, their mooring buoy, so they're not shading the same spot over time. But we can't get the regulatory agencies on board with this, and I say that endearingly as a former regulator. So we did have a lot of resources. Again, we use these quadrats to count seagrass blades and estimate seagrass density. We had corals growing on hard bottom. We had a variety of resources down there. But we were able to design a managed mooring field in areas that had sufficient water depths and less dense resources, avoiding the naval station no-entry areas that provided some moorings for some of these vessels. So in the state of Florida, you can anchor anywhere on state lands except for designated no-anchoring zones. And a lot of communities want the ability to regulate anchoring, and they can't. But if they have a managed mooring field, they can regulate anchoring within the managed mooring field. The problem is you can't incorporate any additional area into the mooring field that you don't actually need. And so it's been a challenging thing. A lot of communities, you put a managed mooring field in, the boats just move somewhere else. And so what the city of Miami did with theirs was they actually had a designated area for anchoring for vessels that didn't want to go into the managed mooring field. And that worked pretty well at Dinner Key. This is a project coming up on the Gulf side of Florida, still in the Florida Keys. This is Isla Mirada Fish Company and Bass Pro Shops. Many people may be familiar with this site. So we've got the Bass Pro Shops Marina on the north side, west side, and then we've got the Isla Mirada Fish Company on the east side. So within the Bass Pro Shops Marina, very dense seagrass coverage, a lot of nurse sharks, a lot of manatees, and a lot of tarpon. And a lot of seagrass. We've got mangroves along the shoreline here, but we've got some shoaling in there. It didn't look like they ever dredged under some of these piers, and so it was shallower in there, but at low tide, we had some slips that were unusable because they were exposed at low tide. Well, in Monroe County, you can't dredge seagrasses, period. No dredging seagrasses, no dredging hard bottom, and no way around it. But we were able to design dredging in the little area in here that was preventing the vessels from getting to the fuel dock, and in some of these slips here that are not usable at low tide. So they're going to be going out to bid very shortly. We got our permits to do that because we avoided the impacts to resources. In the Isla Mirada Fish Company, they've got some really dilapidated old conch-style walls, which are, you know, just haphazard sandbags and whatnot thrown down there, that are obviously having some issues with being beyond their design life, if you want to call it a design life. And where the restaurant is out on the pier, they're underwater, the ground, the peninsula, is actually underwater when we have our king tides. And so we've designed seawall replacements for all of those structures to provide resilient seawalls and to elevate the restaurant so that they actually can continue to operate when they have king tides and have patrons out there. We're also replacing this commercial pier because it's dilapidated and can't blame that one on hurricane damage. That one is lack of maintenance. So this is the type of dense seagrass resources that we have at this facility, and it's challenging because we've got a lot of marinas in the Keys, for example, where people want to dredge, they want to maintenance dredge, they want to accommodate larger boats, and it's just a flat-out no. They can't do it. The county regulations, the state regulations, the Corps regulations, and the National Marine Fisheries Service regulations don't allow it. And so at some point, maybe politically, things will change, but right now we're doing the best we can with what we have. I've got the former director of secretary of the Department of Environmental Professionals who was calling me about a rock outcrop in an entrance channel to a very high-end, prestigious neighborhood in the North Keys, and you can't dredge it. You can't remove it. Everybody knows it's there. Everybody goes around it. So this is the U.S. Coast Guard station in Key West. They needed to do some maintenance along their bulkheads, and so we were asked to do a seagrass survey there, see what corals they had. Well, again, being in Key West, water quality is fantastic. Water quantity, water movement, water clarity is beautiful, and we had a lot of corals. Relatively freezing. I think the biologists were going to kill me for sending them down there. We didn't have those fancy systems where you pump hot water into your wetsuit while you're working, and we didn't have dry suits, and they were dying while they were doing this. But we ended up designing a benthic survey that involved vertical transects down the face of the wall, and we quantified the corals growing within those vertical transects. Now, if they want to replace any of those walls, we've got to do 100% coverage. But what we were doing was, when we do our surveys, we either do a qualitative survey or a quantitative survey. If they're ready to go to permit application and we're positive this is the footprint of the project, we can do a quantitative survey. But for a lot of projects, we start out with a qualitative survey. What's out there? What are our permitting challenges going to be? And then we may need to go back out there and do a more detailed survey. This is a project on the west coast of Florida called The Bay, and it's actually a really exciting project with doing everything the right way. This is actually the south phase of the three-phase project, and it's being spearheaded by the Bay Consortium. It's being funded through grants and philanthropy, and this is a mangrove creek that goes through the property here. Old Children's Museum that was demolished. This is all being changed into a park. There's an old boat launch here that we're making into a kayak pier so that people can paddleboard and kayak through here. This is a performing arts center that may get moved further inland. Again, resiliency, climate change. And the there's different talk on what to do with that structure. Do we take the roof off and make it so that it can be flooded and used for different purposes as we go? So we jumped in the water, and you can see these shorter transects. Our initial request was to do a seagrass survey across the whole property, which went from the south end of the project all the way up to through the three phases. And we arbitrarily did transects about that long. And we found seagrasses, we delineated the seagrasses, and modified their original design to avoid and minimize impacts of those resources. Well, we came back out and we did more dense transects, and we found a lot of corals growing in the deeper areas here, and they were just growing haphazardly all over. And so the original design of the project included these two shore perpendicular piers that we now know would go right out and shade seagrasses. This is the north end of the project. There's actually a boat ramp here on this little canal upland cut that they're talking about moving out here. We'll see if that actually happens. We redesign it. They had all these crossings across the mangroves. And so we had a lot of coral, a lot of seagrass, and a lot of mangroves. So this is a little pinch point up towards the front that we want to open up so that the kayakers and paddleboarders can get out. They had this cute little pygmy seahorse in there too. So we've redesigned the pier to be this really cool spiral pier. This is one of the initial redesigns that had a wider pier all the way around. You can see that it's been narrowed even further through these segments that traverse seagrasses. And those areas will have light penetrating material. Typically fiberglass graded decking is used, but the board of directors includes the one of the owners from PGT Windows, and he wants to look at incorporating different types of window material to allow sunlight to penetrate. So we've got the main pier out here to this little area that appears to be between seagrass and corals for the most part. We will have to flag that entire footprint, go out, identify every coral, and move every coral that's in the footprint when we get there. We've sited this part of the pier that traverses the creek so that our pilings are not impacting primary trunks of mangroves, and this is an existing crossing that we're just going to resurface and improve, and then this one has been sited to avoid and minimize impacts to resources. So I've got some Caribbean project examples, but it looks like we're at about time. Had a couple questions during the presentation, but if anyone wants to, any other questions? I mean, I could go through the Caribbean projects if we want. Yes, no, we good? Well, with that, being that we're at time and I know there's another session coming up, I think we'll stop here. Thank you.